From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, actor W.H. Macy on the acting technique he developed with David Mamet. Currently starring in the film Magnolia as a has-been child genius, and he has a recurring role on the TV show Sports Night. Also, Isn't She Great is the new film about writer Jacqueline Suzanne, author of Valley of the Dolls. We'll hear from Suzanne's editor, Michael Korda. We'll talk about his adventures editing Jacqueline Suzanne and also Harold Robbins, who both brought sex to the world of the bestseller. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A federal judge in Miami has set an earlier date to hear an appeal by the Florida relatives of Elian Gonzalez. Yesterday, the judge set March 6th to hear arguments on whether the suit filed by the boy's relatives should be dismissed. Today, he moved the date up to February 22nd in a response to arguments from government lawyers who said that failure to return Elian to his father in Cuba would harm efforts to get other countries to return abducted American children. In Washington, meanwhile, Attorney General Janet Reno met with the nun who provided a neutral site for the boy to meet with his grandmothers this week. The nun, Sister Jean O'Loughlin, said she now believes the boy should remain in the United States. With just 5 days to go before the New Hampshire presidential primary, Democrat Bill Bradley continued his attack on Al Gore today, charging the vice president has built a campaign on misleading statements and distortions of Bradley's proposals. Bradley also accepted the endorsement of one of the nation's prominent independent politicians. NPR's Anthony Brooks reports from Newport, New Hampshire.
In an effort to reach out to New Hampshire's large and crucial block of independent voters, Bradley was endorsed today by former Connecticut Governor Lowell Weicker. Weicker is a former Republican-turned-independent who's been mentioned as a possible Reform Party presidential candidate. Seeking votes in western New Hampshire today, Bradley said he regrets he couldn't keep his campaign positive and continue to assail the tactics of Al Gore.
If a candidate doesn't trust the people enough to tell them the truth, then how will you expect that as a president he'd tell the truth?
Gore has spent much of the last few weeks portraying Bradley as callous to farmers and a threat to the economy and Medicare. But today, with polls suggesting he's leading here, Gore said he would emphasize the positive. Anthony Brooks, NPR News, Newport, New Hampshire.
Prime Minister Tony Blair warned corporate leaders and heads of government gathered in Davos, Switzerland, that they could not afford another indecisive and unpopular meeting like that in Seattle. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Davos.
Tony Blair said the WTO must open to the public to build consensus for a new round of trade talks this year. The worst thing we could do for the developing countries would be to shelve the trade liberalization agenda and sit back while trade barriers were re-erected, he said. The director general of the WTO said the body had become a lightning rod for anger about globalism, which he said had become the ism to hate. A lively discussion today on the sidelines of the forum underscored the deep divide in world views. Activists blasted free trade drives in developing countries as raising the standard of living for only a few at the expense of many. With the Swiss army on call, protesters are expected to be thwarted in their attempts to demonstrate at the venue tomorrow when President Clinton becomes the first U.S. president to address this annual Alpine gathering. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Davos.
The Dow lost 289 points. This is NPR. Authorities in North Texas say four people have been killed in traffic crashes on the icy roads left by yesterday's powerful storm. The icy buildup also broke power lines, leaving thousands of people without electricity and forcing the cancellation of hundreds of airline flights. The storm kept rolling east, dropping more than a foot of snow in parts of Arkansas and Mississippi this morning. Forecasters warn that more snow and icy conditions could develop from Alabama to the Carolinas. The former president of Chad, Hissin Habre, may soon be tried for human rights abuses. The trial would be in Senegal, where he's been living quietly in exile for many years. David Hecht reports from Dakar.
In preliminary hearings here today, a Senegalese judge heard the testimony of Habre's alleged victims. Human rights groups are calling the case Africa's Augusto Pinochet. Reed Brody, head of Human Rights Watch, one of the seven groups who are filing the complaint, says the case would set a precedent.
This is the first time that an African court has opened a case based on human rights crimes.
The current president of Chad, Idriss Deby, ousted Habre in 1990, accusing his regime of 40,000 political killings and 200,000 cases of torture. Although Amnesty International accuses the current regime of hundreds of political killings and says that torture there is still routine. For NPR News, this is David Hecht in Dakar, Senegal.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 289 points to close at 10,739. Declines led advances by 2-1 in very heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 152 points to close at 3,887. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Alltel at alltel.com, bringing information technology solutions to financial and telecommunications clients in nearly 60 countries.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Actor and director William H. Macy is one of the finest interpreters of David Mamet's work. This year, he stars in Mamet's forthcoming film, State in Maine. Macy also appears in the ensemble film Magnolia by Paul Thomas Anderson. He plays former quiz kid Donnie Smith, who's now an adult and a failure. Let's listen to a scene where he's talking to some guys in a bar.
It's real.
You know who I am? You're a friend of the family, I presume. What does that mean?
Nothing special. Just a spoke in the wheel.
You talk in rhymes and riddles and rub-rub-a-dub, but that doesn't mean anything to me. See, I used to be smart. I'm Quiz Kid Donnie Smith. I'm Quiz Kid Donnie Smith from TV.
Might have been before my time. I remember now. I remember in the 60s,
I'm
right?
I'm Quiz Kid Donnie Smith.
Like you said.
Smart kid. Yeah, you got struck by lightning at one time.
So
right?
What?
Yeah, I heard about that.
Did it hurt? Yes.
Lately, Macy's become a familiar face on television. He has a recurring role on the ABC hit series Sports Night and also appeared as Dr. David Morgenstern on ER. Macy co-founded the Atlantic Theater Company with David Mamet. The company is celebrating its 15th anniversary by staging a series of Mamet plays, including American Buffalo, starring Macy and Philip Baker Hall. The play is currently in London and opens in New York in March. The company practices an acting technique developed by Macy and Mamet. You're about to get a demonstration. When Terry spoke with William H. Macy in 1993, actor-director Neil Pepe joined him to perform what must be David Mamet's shortest play. It's 2 minutes and 6 seconds long. Here's Macy to introduce it.
Mamet wrote this about how many years ago?
Must have been at least 10, more probably.
Yeah, Dave lives up in Vermont, and he wrote a collection of Vermont pieces called Vermont Sketches, as a matter of fact. And they're published in one of his books. This one's called Deer Dogs. And it is, in many states, but I know in Vermont, if a dog runs deer, that is, if a dog chases deer, you can shoot the dog. Because they have a tendency to run in packs, the dogs, and they'll run a deer to death. And so the law is, you can shoot dogs that run deer, because I guess the dog is supposed to be tied down. So this is Deer Dogs by Buffalo Dave Mamet.
Dogs running deer should be shot.
But who's to tell it's running deer? Law says you see a dog in pursuit of a deer, you can shoot him. Who's to say? Wait, you take Dave here, keeps his dog tied up. One day the dog, say Larry Thompson's dog, is running by. Dave's dog gets loose. Larry's dog's running deer. Someone sees it down the road later on, Larry's dog and Dave's dog. What does he do? Shoot them both.
How did Dave's dog get loose?
I'm saying a dog which is usually tied down, Dave's dog.
How did it get loose?
I'm saying one day when it is loose. I don't know how it got loose.
And was it running deer?
No.
How do you know?
Because it hasn't got a taste for him. It's a tame dog.
Well, how do you know?
Well, now, because it is a tame dog. You know that dog.
I know what you're...
Wait a second. I know what you're saying, that the dog is... Though the dog is tame, it gets loose, it starts running deer. Is that it?
Yeah.
But what I'm saying, this case, we know that the dog is tame. It's tame. It isn't running deer, all right? It's Dave's dog. It's tame. It's been tied up constantly.
How does it get loose?
Well, say Dave forgot to tie it up.
And where does it go?
I
Where does it go?
I know what you're saying. It goes to the woods. All right.
What is it doing out there?
It's out. With Larry Thompson's dog.
What are they doing?
Larry's dog's running deer.
And what is Dave's dog doing?
I don't know.
Well, I don't know either, but I'm going to assume it's running deer.
Would you shoot it?
Yes, I would.
You'd shoot Dave's dog?
Yes, I would.
You'd shoot Dave's dog?
Yes, I would.
Because you know that that's the dog that'll be caught. Not Larry Thompson's dog. That's the dog that will be caught. Shoot. It's a bad law. I'm sorry, I don't like it.
Well, you'll like it when you go out in the woods and there ain't no deer.
No, sir. No, sir. And I'm going to tell you one more thing. What the law... Wait a second. Now, what the law encourages a fella to do is... I'm not saying you or me, but what it sets a man up to do is to say, I'm going to shoot that fella's dog. That's not right.
That's great.
That's deer dogs.
That's great. That's William Macy and Neil Pepe. Neil Pepe is the artistic director of the Atlantic Theater Company, and William Macy is the director of the company. You know, I think listening to David Mamet dialogue has made me more aware of the indirect ways that we talk to each other, you know, the way we kind of talk around things almost.
Yes.
I'm wondering, there's so many, like, interruptions and overlaps in the dialogue in not only this play, but in a lot of Mamet writing. How do you rehearse that? How do you rehearse the rhythms with each other?
Well, the main trick is you have to finish the sentences. You have to know what the lines, the words that you don't say, you have to know what they are, or basically what they are. As far as the rhythms go, they're inherent in the writing. They reveal themselves to you when you rehearse the thing. Dave also has this acting technique, which the Atlantic Theater Company is all about, which is called practical aesthetics. And one of the tenets of that technique is that you can't act the words. You can only act the action. You can only figure out what the character, quote-unquote, the character wants in terms of the objective, i.e. what he wants from the other person. And you, through an analytical process, you figure out what that means to you. And that's what you act. Mm-hmm. And the words, essentially, are gibberish. You let them go. Let them come out as they will.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I'm thinking when somebody's talking over you, it's like a little collision in dialogue. And your impulse is to stop. I mean, well, some people go on, somebody else will you don't know whether you should stop or continue, but it's very jarring when it happens. Does that happen to you when you're rehearsing dialogue in which there are those overlaps and interruptions?
Yeah. Yeah. The first couple of times you do it, it's swell for the actor because someone interrupts you and you're... It's offensive. It's, well, let me finish. The trick is the 600th time you've done that speech to still be offended when you get interrupted.
Right. To still have it feel abrupt and like a collision.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a great way of putting it, though, a bunch of collisions. It's like several people running down a hallway trying to get to the door at the same time.
Neil, thanks a lot for joining us for the performance part.
Absolutely.
Of the program. Thanks, and good luck with the night of the benefit.
All right, I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye. Bill Macy, how did you start working with David Mamet?
I went to a school in Vermont called Goddard College, and David had just graduated, and he came back as, I believe they called him, a teaching fellow, and so he was my teacher. And he taught an acting technique that was roughly Stanislavskian, and more specifically, it was the way Sandy Meisner taught. And he was my teacher, and he was the most outrageous man I'd ever met in my life, and he started writing plays. He came in one day with this collection of short sketches called Sexual Perversity in Chicago. And just about all of us looked at this writing and thought, this is pretty peculiar. This is brand new. And from there, we started a company together called the St. Nicholas Theater. We started it in college, and through a bunch of moves, it ended up in Chicago. And there at the St. Nicholas in Chicago, we did a lot of Dave's first plays and a lot of other people's plays, too, and it was quite successful. And we just hung out together. I presently owe him money, so it ensures my future employment.
If he pays you, you get to pay him back?
Yeah, I think he's going to make sure I keep getting jobs until I pay him off.
So had you been directed by anybody before working with Mamet?
Oh, yeah, I did plays in high school and in college. But what David brought to it, the first thing that he brought to the whole subject of being an actor, which is really what my early college days were about, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just knew that the only thing I'd ever been successful at or enjoyed was acting. What David brought to it was a sense of pride. He charged us as students to look at the whole thing in a broader sense, what our role in society was and what our responsibilities were. And he did it from a very Russian point of view, a very selfless, either get it together or get out, the world doesn't need you kind of an attitude. And he impressed on us, as Stanislavski said, that the task of the actor was to bring to the stage the life of the human soul, which is a lofty phrase, but he brought it right down to the nitty-gritty. And as a result, he had a work ethic in that class, which has never left me and held me in good stead, and which I've been trying to spread in the community also. Such things as be on time. It sounds like a silly thing, but in David's classes, if you were not on time, which was about 3 minutes before the class was to begin, the door was locked. Don't come in.
Really?
Do not come in.
Were you ever late?
Once or twice.
And you missed it?
Absolutely. And a couple of times it would be after you'd spent all week working on a scene that you were dying to do.
And how was that good discipline?
Well, yeah, about the second time you were late, you decided, perhaps I should not be late anymore. It would be so much easier to be on time than to go through all of this angst.
We're featuring a 1993 interview with actor-director W.H. Macy. We'll hear more of his conversation with Terry Gross after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back with a 1993 interview with actor W.H. Macy. He's featured in the new film Magnolia and appears on the hit TV series Sports Night.
Now, your students have written a book called A Practical Handbook for the Actor, which is based on the style of acting that you and David Mamet teach. In the introduction to the book, Mamet says that most acting is based on shame and guilt. Was that your experience when you were studying acting?
That was my experience when I studied anything in school. It's true. It's particularly bad in the acting profession for a couple of reasons. One, there is such a thing as the muse, and every once in a while, she will visit the actor, and you do the best work you've ever done. And you go back after the performance and say, what was it that allowed me to be that good? And it is indefinable. And so that's a very seductive thing. And what a lot of acting teachers try to do is capture the muse. They try to contain it somehow. And it can't be done. It cannot be done. Sometimes God just visits you and you are wonderful that night. To put your attention on that is folly because it's not controllable. What you can put your attention on is technique. And technique is something that is within your control. And so as Stanislavski said, play well or play badly, but play truthfully. And I think a lot of acting teachers, because they have no technique, because they've never sat down and said, what exactly is the technique, not the art, but the technique of acting, because they've never answered that question for themselves, what they try to teach is feelings. And feelings are so elusive, and emotions, that they end up talking gibberish to the students. And as David says in that introduction, there is a conspiracy. The students will not call the teachers on talking gibberish, and as a result, the teachers will praise the students sometime and damn them others. And generally speaking, with a lot of acting classes, it makes no sense on an intellectual level. It offends your intellect, your intelligence.
Did you study how to use emotional memory for performances, and do you consider that a legit or a gibberish approach?
I did study it briefly, and it's just so much nonsense. It doesn't work.
Explain how it's supposed to work and why it didn't work for you.
Well, the Stanislavski technique broke down into two sections. One was emotional preparation, and the other was the sense of objective, the through line, the action of the piece. Stanislavski invented basically both of those phrases. In the early part of his life, he worked a lot on emotional preparation, which Lee Strasberg was the champion of. And the way it works is, if I'm going to do this piece called Deer Dogs, and I'm playing the character Bunchy, and I'm trying to convince the other character, Larry, that it's wrong to shoot a dog, I would come up with an emotional... I would figure out what the emotional state that Bunchy is in. I would come up with an analogous emotional state that I have been through and put myself into that emotional state, and the speech would then take care of itself. Well, that's foolishness on many levels. One, it's almost impossible to control your emotions, in my opinion. You cannot control your emotions. And to whatever extent you can, it's really outside of any usefulness toward acting. Two, acting, in my opinion, doesn't have anything to do with emotions. And as a matter of fact, they are beside the point. Acting has to do with actions, which brings us to the second half of Stanislavski. And Sandy Meisner at the Neighborhood Playhouse was the great proponent of that. And that is figuring out what the character wants and acting that. In other words, my only job is to get the actor that I'm acting with, in this case it was Neil Pepe, was to get him to change his mind. And it's my job to do that, me personally. William H. Macy, I've got to change Neil Pepe, not some character doing it, because the character doesn't really exist. So I've sort of spun off into the stratosphere on you, but the idea is you can't control your emotions, so leave them outside. They will come or they will not come on their own, and there's nothing you can do about it.
So you don't teach emotional preparation for a theater piece?
No. On the contrary, we say we don't care how you feel about it, and if you really want to know the truth, how you feel about it is relatively boring. I don't know who said it, but boring emotions are fun to indulge in, but tiresome to watch.
What's the most emotion-packed scene that you've had to do in your career?
I don't know. I've died a couple of times, and this play, Oleana, at the end, I mean, this woman has wrecked his life. But, you know, Terry, I thought it was interesting, for me at least, what happened to me over the course of Oleana, which ran for 9 months, was that I consistently found myself going back to that final scene, which is so emotional and so charged, and saying to myself, settle down, cut out all that stuff. Once a week, I would have to go back and say to myself, simplify, simplify, because I would just fall in love with these little emotional turns and explosions that I'd come up with, and I would try to repeat them. And they're just not, they're beside the point.
So what would you be throwing overboard specifically?
Well, you know, one night I would let out some earth-shattering sighs. As a matter of fact, I did that one night, and it was quite a swell moment. I was quite proud of it. But, you know, being the cheap fellow that I am, I tried to do it the following night. And it didn't sound like a sigh. It sounded like I had emphysema, and I think it was just awful. So, you know, like the third night, I finally got it together to say, hey, practice what you preach. Just let that stuff go. There's another rule here, too, which I think many actors fall afoul of, and acting teachers by extension, which is, if you cry, the audience won't. If you get upset, the audience won't. What they're doing is having, they're vicariously, they're up on stage with you going through the thing at the same time. That's why we like to watch things. That's why our heart picks up when we're watching TV, and the bad guys are right around the corner, and the good guy's walking right into a trap. Your heart's pounding, because you're there, you're part of the thing. Well, if the actors pump up the emotion and essentially tell the audience everything that they're supposed to be feeling, it robs them of the experience. Much better, play it close to the chest and don't let all of that stuff out, except the stuff that will come out whether you want it to or not.
Right.
And the audience will get more bang for their buck.
What's it like for you when you do an audition for a movie and you get your time with the casting director, with the director, and you have a limited amount of time to make a good impression?
It's your worst nightmare. It's, you know, those nightmares you have when you wake up and you say, whew, thank God I was only dreaming. Well, it's like that, except you weren't dreaming. It was real.
Right.
It's a hideous thing. It's hideous, particularly when it's a great role for you and you know you could just kick it to no end. And you've got to prove yourself to those people. And I happen to be rotten at it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not good at it at all.
What goes wrong for you at those auditions?
Oh, I have a tendency to get angry when I have to audition, and so because I can't be angry, I end up being ironic and saying funny things that aren't that funny and are generally very insulting. They flew me out to L.A. one time for a series, and it had come down to me. I thought I had negotiated the money, which was more money than Canada takes in yearly. I thought my life was made. So they fly me out to L.A., didn't tell me anything. I walk into this room. There are three guys that are identical to me sitting there looking like they're going to explode from nervousness. And it turns out I didn't know the gig, but there are four of us for this role, and then there are four other roles that each have four people. All these people sitting in a room. I mean, you could have, if you could have figured out how to harness that energy, you could have run L.A. For a month on the energy of these people just sitting there sweating. And then one at a time, everybody goes into this giant room that had a 16-foot table with all these suits sitting at it, off in the dark, and in this lighted space, you get up and you do your thing. And they decide whether you're going to be rich for the next 5 years and perhaps a movie star for the rest of your life, or whether you're going to just get back on the airplane. Well, I freaked out. I walked into the room. I looked at these people. My hand to God, I looked at them and I said, would those of you who are important stand up? Well, that was that. They didn't crack a smile. So I went through and I did my audition, but yo, boy.
Oh, wow. Did you know you were going to say that?
No, I just knew that I was furious. It's so inhuman.
Well, Bill Macy, it's been great to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
You bet.
W.H. Macy. Macy stars in David Mamet's forthcoming film, State and Maine. He currently stars with Philip Baker Hall in the Atlantic Theater Company's production of Mamet's American Buffalo in London. The play opens in New York in March. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From Delacorte Press, publisher of The Tidal Pool by Karen Harper, the romantic historical mystery featuring Queen Elizabeth I as a detective. From World Wildlife Fund, known by its panda logo, working in more than 100 countries around the globe to leave our children a living planet. On the web, worldwildlife.org. And from Eddie Bauer, supporting radio expeditions and offering outdoor-inspired clothing, accessories, and home furnishings. In stores, catalogs, and at eddiebauer.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, editing Jacqueline Suzanne, author of Valley of the Dolls. We talk with her editor, Michael Korda. The new film, Isn't She Great, is about Suzanne. It stars Bette Midler and the score is by Burt Bacharach. We're listening to it now.
I don't know where I'm going, but I'm on my way. As I go through life, somewhere in the world, there's a place. Where I will buy me a new life. I don't know where I'm going, but that's still okay. My dream is out there. Never gonna stop till that dream is mine. Wanna see what life's all about. Get away to go and search for something that people call the good times. Let the good times come and turn my life around. I just gotta go and find the future and leave the past behind me.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Isn't She Great? The new film about best-selling novelist Jacqueline Suzanne opens in theaters today. The film is based on a chapter from Michael Korda's memoir, Another Life, about the people he's worked with during his more than 40 years in the publishing world. Besides Suzanne, Korda edited such authors as Graham Greene, Larry McMurtry, Tennessee Williams, Harold Robbins, Carlos Castaneda, Joan Crawford, Ronald Reagan, and Richard Nixon. Jacqueline Suzanne is best known for her book Valley of the Dolls. Bette Midler plays Suzanne in the new film. Nathan Lane plays her husband and manager, Irving Mansfield. And David Hyde Pierce plays her editor, Michael Hastings. In this scene, Hastings has gone to Suzanne's place to talk to the couple about Suzanne's book.
What the hell's wrong with you? It's dawn, for crying out loud.
Miss Suzanne, I'm Michael Hastings, your editor. We have a lot of work to do. I have a great many comprehensive notes.
Notes? What do you mean, notes?
For changes, for your book.
Changes? Like spelling?
Miss Suzanne, your manuscript at present is nigh unto incoherent.
And that's bad?
Ah! Yes?
Well, Mr. Bickey, Buster, you just hold on.
Where's she going?
Isn't she great?
David Hyde Pierce's character, Michael Hastings, is based on Michael Korda. Terry spoke to Korda last year.
You edited Jacqueline Suzanne. You got her after Valley of the Dolls, which was published in 1966. And you did her book, Love Machine.
The Love Machine.
Excuse me.
The V is very important.
Why is it so important?
Because it was important to Jackie.
Oh, okay. you talk in your book about how important Valley of the Dolls was in terms of its impact on publishing. How do you think Valley of the Dolls changed the publishing industry?
Valley of the Dolls essentially proved that you can take the elements of a woman's romance novel, i.e., to write a really big tearjerker, but that you can combine them with a roman à clé about real people like Judy Garland, who is, of course, one of the characters in Valley of the Dolls, and a lot of inside show business stuff, and that you can put in a whole lot of really tough, salacious, down-to-earth, dirty stuff a la Harold Robbins, but from a woman's point of view. So nobody had ever put all these things together in one book. Everybody figured that they were separate categories, that you could have big romance tearjerkers, or you could have big, salacious, tough, sexy novels like Harold Robbins, or you could have roman à clé celebrity novels about the entertainment industry. But Jackie very perceptibly realized that you could put all these three things together in one book, and that's what Valley of the Dolls is.
I think she changed the way books are sold and marketed in a way, too.
Yes, because coming out of the entertainment business, Jackie felt that the book could be marketed like anything else. And so Jackie was the first person really to make the author the center of the campaign, not the book. She was the first person to make the booksellers into allies by building up a huge Rolodex with every bookseller in the country and every bookstore clerk in the country with their names, their favorite flower, their astrological sign, the names of their dogs or children, their birthdays. I mean, Jackie had in her palm tens of thousands of booksellers all across the United States who were absolutely fanatically loyal to her. And finally, she was the one who opened up, for the first time, the ability of the novelist to go on television and sell a novel as if it were a product. It was not for nothing that she had sold Shifley embroidery as the Shifley girl on television for all those years. She simply took that and applied it to a book. Before that, people would have said, oh, you can't do that, and if you could do that, it would be vulgar and awful and wrong. But once Jackie had done it, it made perfect sense to everybody.
What was that like for you to work with somebody who was marketing herself as well as her book? I mean, she had become such a celebrity. Did it make it harder for you to work with her?
Well, as you will have gathered from my own life, career, and so forth, I'm not somebody who shies away from people turning themselves into celebrities for the purposes of their books. I adore Jackie. First of all, let me say that Jackie was a terrific person to be around. I should tell you that I used to edit Jackie by sitting next to her in her pink apartment at the Navarro in Central Park South, and she had a pink IBM Selectric typewriter and typed on pink paper. And she, in all her typing and writing career, she had never discovered the shift key, so she typed only in capital letters like a very long telegram. And she would type one page. Also, she didn't punctuate. She would type one page, and she would hand it to me and say, "Read this, doll." And I would read it, and I would make some suggestions. And then she would explode, and we would have an enormous knockdown, drag-out, screaming fight, at the end of which she would accept some of my suggestions, which she would carry out by herself on the page using an eyebrow pencil to make her corrections. And then she would put that page to one side and put a new sheet of pink paper in the typewriter and move on to the next page. The point being, A, that Jackie cared very much about what she was writing and worked very hard at it, but B, that if you were going to edit her, she expected you to fight. If you didn't fight, then you weren't sincere. You didn't care. So every page had to be fought over. She truly brought to those books an enormous energy. I mean, for one thing, in Valley of the Dolls and the Love Machine, she opened up the woman's novel to frank scenes of abortion, oral sex, all sorts of things which hitherto had been thought to be stuff that you did in pornographic novels printed in Paris, as opposed to enormous romantic women's bestsellers. She opened it up to stuff that women knew was happening, and even to some degree was happening in their own lives, but had never read about in escapist fiction before. And in doing that, she truly changed the face of American publishing and American fiction.
Now, how did you find out about her secret life, the life that she tried to keep from her fans, that she had breast cancer, that she had an autistic son?
I did not know about that till the end of Jackie's life. I always used to wonder why the Mansfields owned a Cadillac and kept it downstairs in the garage, Cadillac convertible, because they never had, so far as one could tell, any kind of domestic life except occasionally sitting home and making phone calls to the coast. They were out every evening. There was never anything in their refrigerator. There was no evidence that they had any kind of a personal life. And they didn't have a country house. They didn't have a place in East Hampton. They didn't do anything like that. So I could never figure out why they needed to keep a Cadillac downstairs in the garage. Well, it turned out that the Cadillac was kept in their garage because every Sunday the Mansfields got in and drove up to this institution in Connecticut where their son Guy was kept, who was totally autistic. And I think that one of the things about Jackie that has to be appreciated, and I think I make this clear in the book, is that Jackie came of that generation that truly believed the show business style, which was that you never let the public see you crying, you never let the public see you hurt. The fact that she was dying of breast cancer, the fact that she had an autistic child, these were things which today she would reveal to People magazine in a shot. In fact, she would kill to have these things on in People magazine. But for Jackie in her day, the public was only supposed to see the smiling, happy side of your life. They weren't supposed to know there was a downside. And so she bottled this up, which took a tremendous amount of courage, and kept it from us all. We didn't know that she was in pain. We didn't know that she was dying. We didn't know that she'd had a failed double mastectomy. We didn't know that there was an autistic child. You would never have guessed that from the Mansfields.
Michael Korda. The new film, Isn't She Great?, about Jacqueline Suzanne, is based on a chapter from Korda's memoir, Another Life, about Suzanne and the many other authors Korda edited in his long publishing career. We'll return to Terry's interview with Michael Korda after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with an interview Terry Gross recorded with editor Michael Korda last year. His memoir of his 40 years in publishing is Another Life.
One of the authors who you worked with much earlier in your career was Harold Robbins, best known for The Carpetbaggers. And I think, you know, the reason why he was such a popular best-selling author was the sexual content of his books, which was particularly racy in the period that he was writing in the 60s. Was your job as editor to make sure there was enough sex, or to make sure that the sex wasn't going to get the publishing company into trouble? I mean, how were you supposed to deal with the, at that time, pretty explosive sexual content of his book?
Well, it's interesting that you should say that, because I don't altogether agree with you. First of all, you never had to worry about there being enough sex in Harold Robbins, because there was always more than enough, or sometimes too much. But curiously enough, that's not what I think made Harold a great bestseller. I think the sex was, as it were, the icing on the cake, though I realize that sounds like a sexual metaphor.
Yes, it does.
The kind of scenes in his books. But what made him a bestseller was that he was a wonderful, wonderful storyteller. That his books had a beginning, a middle, and an end, a tremendous narrative thrust and drive. They moved very fast. You were taken from one page to the next, from one chapter to the next, unable to stop reading. In a way, the sex scenes detracted from that because they tended to slow the reader down and stop the reader. But the readers expected it, so of course it had to be there. When Harold began to be less successful as a writer was when his storytelling drive began to fail him, and he simply substituted more and more sex scenes for the original narrative drive and excitement of his books. The Carpetbaggers is, in fact, an almost perfect good-bad novel, one of those great big good-bad novels. I've published a lot of them in my time, and I really love them. Carpetbaggers and The Adventurers were, of course, very special by Harold, but it's exactly the same that's true for, say, Jacqueline Suzanne's The Love Machine, or for the novels of Jackie Collins today, or any of these major, big, best-selling good-bad novelists. Their chief ability is to keep the story moving.
So which Harold Robbins books did you do?
I did not myself edit The Carpetbaggers, though I was sort of tangentially involved with it. But sometime after The Adventurers, I became Harold Robbins' editor for the rest of his life.
So what were the standards of language and sexual content for the time?
Well, people were shocked by what there is in Harold. But in fact, if you go back and read Robbins' books, the sex scenes are shocking, but the use of words is not necessarily so shocking. It's curious. I think people are more shocked by obscene words, or were then, than by obscene actions and scenes. Harold today would, I think, read fairly tamely. I recently reread The Carpetbaggers because I wanted to read, of course, that favorite sex scene of all American popular fiction in which the woman gives the man a body shave in the tub, and it's a tub full of champagne, that's right. The tub is full of champagne, and he gets into it, and she shaves his entire body. And I found it actually not terribly stimulating, perhaps because I really don't want to be shaved all over by anyone. But it seemed to me pretty tame. For the time, however, it was sensational.
I have to say, I bet that would really sting a lot, because if you got shaved in a tub of alcohol, that's going to sting a little bit.
Well, but that might add, you know.
It's possible.
A little sting would be a help.
So was it ever embarrassing for you to work on his books?
No,
I don't mean artistically embarrassing. I mean, you know, having to talk with him about the sexual content or language.
No, you know, I come out of the movie business. I never worked in the movie business, but my entire family is in the movie business, so I like to think that I'm comparatively unshockable. No, I was never shocked by Harold. I found him an extremely difficult man to deal with, and on the whole, one of the most graceless, ungrateful, and genuinely grumpy and ill-tempered people that I've ever had the pleasure of working with, but I was not particularly shocked by his language. In any case, at that time, book publishing itself was going through a period in which almost everybody swore like troopers, because it was just at that period where people were showing their liberation from the traditional good manners and somewhat laid-back quality of book publishing by using an expletive in almost every sentence.
What year are you thinking of?
This would be beginning of the 60s, just before the Berkeley Free Speech Movement.
Right. Tell that great story about the characters' names in two different halves of one of his books.
Well, I used to edit Harold Robbins very gingerly because he himself was one of those writers who are not, as a matter of fact, all that rare, who liked everything about being a best-selling writer except doing the writing. He hated writing. And in fact, the only way in which you could get Harold Robbins to write a book was to wait until his debts from the house in Acapulco and the house in California and the yacht and the wife and the ex-wife and the children and the IRS had run up so high that he actually had to start writing, at which point his agent, lawyer, Paul Gitlin, would lock him in a bungalow in the Beverly Hills Hotel and tell Harold that he would only allow Harold to have room service after Harold had passed under the door so many pages. So Harold would have to sit at the typewriter typing and type, say, let's say 20 pages, at which point Harold would allow him to order a sandwich and a cup of coffee. And that's how Harold would write enough pages to get the next payment for the book, whatever it was. Say 200 pages, he got another $250,000, which was a lot of money for the day. But then the moment he got the money, he would run off again to the south of France in the yacht and stop writing and start spending until the next crisis obliged to pick up writing again. Well, in the case of writing this particular book, there had been a several-month hiatus between finishing one section of it and sitting down to finish the next. And during that time, Harold, who of course never bothered to reread what he had written, vaguely remembered the plot, but had totally forgotten the names of the characters and their physical attributes, except, of course, the sexual attributes, which were the same in all Harold's books. And therefore, the second half of the book bore very little resemblance to the first half of the book. The characters, you could see that they were the same people, but they had different names, different eye colors, different descriptions. Everything about them was, in that sense, quite different. So I went to see Harold Robbins at his hotel in New York when he was visiting to broach this difficult problem to him and said to him, look, it's really a very simple problem. Either we go with the people as they are in part one or the people as they are in part two. All that we have to do is make that decision. I will do the work. I will do the rewriting. I will change the names. I will change the eye colors. I will change everything that has to be done. You just have to tell me whether you want me to use the ones in the first part of the book or the second part of the book. And Harold gave me this kind of, he had this kind of grumpy, angry, tough guy stare. He looked at me and he said, you're telling me I made a mistake. And I said, that's right. He said, you're telling me that the people in the second part of the book are different from the people in the first part of the book because I forgot. I said, that's right. He said, you're telling me that you can fix it. You'll do it all yourself. I said, Harold, I'll do all the work myself. All you have to do is say, follow part one or follow part two. I'll take it away. I'll do the whole thing. You'll never have to look at it again. And Harold thought about it for a moment, and he looked at me, and he gave me this contemptuous glare, and he said, no. So I said, no? What do you mean, no? He said, no. He said, all these years, I've been sweating my brains out, sitting in front of a typewriter, writing novels for these readers. Let them do some work for a change.
Well,
so I said, wait a minute. I protested. I said, you can't do that. You can't have a novel in which somebody's called Jane in the first part and has blue eyes and is called Jeanette in the second part and has green eyes. He said, yes, I can. And his lawyer agent, Paul Gitlin, who was also a friend of mine but a very tough guy indeed, and who looked exactly like Harold, they looked like Tweedledee and Tweedledum, said, you heard the man. He said what he wants. So we printed the book the way it was, and we shipped out hundreds and hundreds of thousands of copies, as we did on any Harold Robbins novels. And the curious thing is, nobody ever wrote in to complain.
Okay. The fact that nobody ever wrote in to complain, I think, kind of proves my point that a lot of people read Harold Robbins for, quote, the good parts, as opposed to his fantastic storytelling ability.
Yes, I think so. Also, they were willing to, Harold had been absolutely right about them. He knew his readers, as every best-selling novelist does. He knew that they would make the jump, that they would figure out that the girl with the big tits in the first part was the same as the girl with the big tits in the second part. The fact that the names were different, they simply could ride right over that. They got the point. Harold had been absolutely right. And I learned from that, actually, that the best thing to do with Harold Robbins was to let him do what he wanted to do.
Editor Michael Korda, his memoir of his life in publishing is Another Life. We'll continue after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's get back to a 1999 interview with Simon & Schuster editor Michael Korda.
Now, you edited two presidential memoirs, memoirs by Nixon and Reagan. What are some of the problems unique to presidential memoirs?
Well, the first problem with presidential memoirs is that presidents almost never tell the truth about anything. And that's difficult because, as a publisher, you feel a kind of vestigial tug that tells you that it would be better if a book contains some truth. Most presidential memoirs are simply exercises in ghost-written fiction presented as nonfiction.
You tell a story about how when you were editing President Reagan's memoir that, you know, it was ghost-written, and I think you were trying to keep that from everybody, make it seem like, you know, Reagan really wrote it himself. And
that's not quite fair. We weren't trying to keep it from everybody. We were just trying to play it down.
Play it down. Thank you.
That's a big distinction.
Much more discreet. Play
it
down.
Keeping it from anybody is lying. Playing it down is just an aspect of marketing.
Thank you. So you and he were posing for a publicity shot as if you were editing on the book together at that moment. And what did Reagan say to you when he left the room?
Well, we were surrounded by photographers and by people from all the news services. I mean, it was a full-scale press conference at which President Reagan and I appeared at this table with a pile of blank paper and a couple of pencils and pretended to be editing this book. It was a contrived photo op. And at the end of it, when everybody had finished, the president stood up and, in his usual jovial way, cheered to the press. And as he was going out through the door, he turned and he said, I hear it's a wonderful book. I'm going to read it myself one of these days when I have time. And was going, only Ronald Reagan could do that.
Did that end up in the newspaper stories?
Of course.
And he wasn't kidding, right? I mean, he didn't mean that as a little joke.
No, I think he did mean it as a little joke, all right. But on the other hand, he, as usual, didn't have any anticipation of the amount of space it would take up in the stories or the amount of inconvenience and discomfort it might cause us. I became very fond of him. Again, politics to one side. I found him a wonderful man to work with. People complain about his memory. And, of course, now it's most unfortunate because he has Alzheimer's. But I never saw any real sign of that. If it was something that interested Ronald Reagan, he had the most wonderful memory in the world. For example, he could tell me the name of every one of his horses. He knew them all the way back. He could tell you everything about, which matters because I'm a horseman as
yes, but on
as
the other hand,
know.
You describe him as basically having no attention span, you know, that when he'd drift away.
Well, he had no attention span when it didn't interest him. If he was talking about his horses, he had a very long attention span. Also, he had a kind of Zelig-like way of placing himself in the forefront of events where he was not, which, again, was not malicious and was not in any way lying. What it was that the Reagan, coming out of show business and an actor, is a wonderful, or was a wonderful, raconteur, one of the best. And over the decades, each of his anecdotes had been honed, told 1,000 times, refined to the point where it was a perfectly tuned and absolutely perfected story. And the president would say, let me tell you the story of it. And he would tell you this wonderful story. He was an actor. He, beginning, middle, end, punchline, he got it all right. The problem with it is that being an actor, over the years, he tended to put himself more and more in the foreground of the story. Thus, he told Yitzhak Rabin and everybody else that he had been the first American to reach Buchenwald and see the horrors of the concentration camps. And when he told Yitzhak Rabin this, Rabin burst into tears because the story was so wonderful and so moving. The only problem is when we put it in the book that we discovered that it wasn't true. Ronald Reagan, of course, had never been outside the United States in the Second World War and spent the entire Second World War in Culver City editing footage from military photographers. He had seen the footage of American troops liberating Buchenwald. But over the years, as he told this story, he gradually moved himself into the foreground of the story until he was the one who had liberated Buchenwald.
Well, I find that terrifying.
Well, no, it's not uncommon, and if you get old enough, you will find yourself doing it yourself. But, of course, being an actor...
Yes, but moving yourself into being the first person in this historic moment is different from forgetting...
But you see, it's Zelig. Remember the film in which Zelig appears everywhere? Eventually, Ronald Reagan's anecdotes always put him into the foreground. done in the most innocent possible way. For example, I tell in the book, Another Life, the story of his speech to the Medal of Honor winners, in which he told this wonderful story about the pilot of a B-17 shot down over Germany who orders the crew to bail out because the plane is on fire and discovers that the bull turret gunner, a young man of 17, is wounded and stuck in his turret in the back and can't get out. So the pilot unfastens his straps, climbs out of the pilot's seat of this crashing airplane, works his way back to where the bull turret is behind the wings, sticks his arm down through the little hatchway, and grips the boy's hand, the dying boy's hand, and says, "Don't sweat it, son. We're going down together."
Mm.
And the Medal of Honor winners all burst into tears and applauded at this wonderful story. The only problem is, as we discovered, that it never really happened. It's in a 1944 war movie that Ronald Reagan saw. But his conviction that it had happened was so strong, his ability to convey, even to the Medal of Honor winners, the pathos and the courage of the story was so powerful that it might as well have happened, if you see what I mean. And you had to guard against that when he wrote his memoirs, because it was my job to be forever in the most embarrassing way saying to the president, "Mr. President, I don't think you can say this." Not an easy role to play. In addition to which, I had to urge upon a very reluctant President Reagan that he had to include at least one sentence in the book to indicate that he had once been married to Jane Wyman, because he or Nancy, whichever one it was determined to leave that out of the book. And I said, "You've got to put it in the book, because I don't care if it's just one sentence, but if you don't say that you were married to Jane Wyman, then the critics and the reviewers will assume that you haven't told the truth about anything else."
Editor Michael Korda. His memoir, Another Life, is the basis for the new film about Jacqueline Suzanne, Isn't She Great?, starring Bette Midler. It opens in theaters today. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Lawyers.com, an online legal resource for finding a lawyer and information about the law, AOL keyword Lawyers.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, trekking through Siberia, we talk with travel writer Colin Thubrun. He's also traveled through China and the Middle East. His book, In Siberia, is part of a three-part series on the vast Russian landmass. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.